Back to the Laura Coates Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Laura Coates Show here on Sirius XM POTUS 866-967-6887. Hey, we're learning more about what might be ahead in terms of the investigation into the shooting death of Helena Hutchinson on the set of Rust. She is a mother, wife, deeply admired colleague, and she was just the age of 43 years old when she was shot on the set as a cinematographer by a so-called prop gun. The director was also shot. He's 48 years old in the same apparently live round that killed cinematographer Helena Hutchins. Excuse me, just 42. She's just 42 years old, excuse me, on the New Mexico set just 6 days ago. Well, the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office held a press conference today and was speaking about these issues and providing additional information about what it is the state of the investigation is right now. And here's what they had to say about this very issue.
The man who pulled the trigger and as a producer on the movie, does Alec Baldwin himself face the potential of criminal charges? And if the DA could perhaps follow up with that as well.
That may be a question better answered by the district attorney.
All options are on the table at this point. I'm not commenting on charges, whether they will be filed or not, or on whom. So the answer is we cannot answer that question yet until we complete a more thorough investigation.
But there is the potential for Alec Baldwin himself to face charges because you have not ruled them out.
No one has been ruled out at this point.
Is Alec Baldwin considered a person of interest right now?
No, that's you.
he's obviously the person that fired the weapon. So we're going to continue interviewing and getting the facts of his statements and the evidence and the case and possible witnesses or anybody that has any information. So right now, he is an active part of this investigation.
Sheriff Don Mendoza also said there was some complacency on the set.
I think the industry has had a record recently of being safe. I think there was some complacency on this set, and I think there are some safety issues that need to be addressed by the industry and possibly by the state of New Mexico, but I'll leave that up to the industry and the state to determine what those need to be.
Let's talk to Richard C. Bell, a civil and liability attorney, to talk about the potential criminal or civil liability and the precedents that have been set in the industry already in terms of how to evaluate these cases and cases like this, of course. Welcome back to the show, Richard C. Bell. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me back, Laura. And I really want to commend you because, you know, the focus has been on Alec Baldwin. Obviously, he's a celebrity. This is a tragic incident. But you got to the essence of what the focus should be. And the focus should be that a 43-year-old mother whose child will never see her again because of someone's negligence is no longer here. And I think we lose that. Unfortunately, we've lost a bit of our humanity. And you didn't. And I commend you for that.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. And I know that I can extend the compliment right back to you because this has been top of mind for you, that very issue of negligence. And I know people think, look, lawyers are always just trying to sue someone. But in reality, the reason you have not only criminal cases, but civil cases can be about deterrence and can be about taking corrective action to ensure that that which has happened never happens again. And this is a real concern in terms of how you would think about, you use the term negligence. And what sticks out to you immediately about when you heard about this case, Richard, what was your immediate reaction? I know the word negligence probably came to mind, notice or duty of care soon to follow.
Yeah, sure. So since this is what I do for a living, the first thing that pops in my head is, so negligence is when someone acts below the standard of care of a reasonably prudent person under the circumstances. In lay language, what it means is, who was supposed to check to make sure, number one, there's no live ammunition in there? Who's supposed to check that every protocol and checklist is scrupulously adhered to? And who is supposed to make sure that you don't hand an actor a gun and say that it's a cold gun that has no ammunition in it? I mean, this sounds like pretty outrageous conduct to me.
You know, let's liken this to the idea of, and I think it's often helpful for people to think about cases when you, if you take away the celebrity aspect, if you take away the specific facts of this case as we know it, and think about the concepts in it, where in areas people are more accustomed to hearing about. And I think about medical negligence as an example. You think of the idea of the passing of a prop gun can be analogized to the passing of some medical instrument or otherwise, right? And the idea, or a supply chain, the idea of by the time you get the car, somebody has looked at the starter, you know, the engine in some respect. They've looked at a starter plug. They've looked at different aspects. So there's a chain of operations that go on that by the time it gets to you, you're supposed to feel safe. And I think that is, when you think about it from that perspective, you know, the duty of care and the standards of what is normal behavior of a reasonable person in that situation really makes more sense to people. And so if you, how does one establish who this reasonably prudent person is? It's a phrase that we often hear, but how does one establish who that is?
Okay. Reasonably prudent person is whoever the jury thinks is a reasonably prudent person. A jury, yes. If it ever goes to that, will decide what was reasonable. I'll give you a great example. You just talked about medical negligence. So I do medical malpractice. I had a case, a woman was in labor. She's giving birth. Everything seems to go well. There's a kind of a changing of the guard because their obstetrician comes in late. He's on call. Another obstetrician starts. Everything ends. Everything seems well. Within a week, she's having horrible pains. They say, don't worry about it. They finally go to the emergency room. They left 7 gauze pads in this woman. So what you were talking about, protocols, you have to do a count. That's one of the most basic things. Nurses and doctors, you have to do a count. Everything that was in this room, make sure it's still here, because otherwise it's probably in the patient. So that's a jury would decide that's not reasonable. So a reasonable doctor wouldn't do something like that.
So the film standards, the industry standards become all the more important. You're talking about the use of, say, prop guns. And this has been a concept that people have been, frankly, fighting against for a while because of the introduction of, you know, computer-generated technology that allows for you to mimic the sound, say, of a real bullet or the look of the flare, the idea of trying to use technology to replace what is obviously very, very dangerous. And if there is a trend towards the use of computer, you know, CGI in some respects, does that mean that the standard of care has also changed? Or can you have sort of competing standards based on the choice of what technology to use?
Well, you can have competing standards, and one of the ways that would come out in a lawsuit here by the estate of Ms. Hutchins would be you would have experts in the field of handling of firearms on sets. And the standard might be it's okay to have them when they're unloaded or to have certain types of blanks in them, and other times technology and have certain protocols. So what the standards are would basically, in a case like this, be testified to by the experts. But I think one of the things we have to say is this isn't new. There was that tragic case of Brandon Lee, Bruce Lee's son, that was back in 1993. He was 28 years old. He's on the set, and in the scene before his scene, there were these hollowed-out cartridges. They call them dummy cartridges, and they were supposed to be removed after that earlier scene was done and replaced with blanks. Well, what happened there was that the tip of one of those dummy bullets, it broke off in the cartridge. But nobody checked the gun before it was used in the next scene. So they didn't know there was still a tip broken off in the gun. And when the gun was shot, it was supposed to be a blank coming out. Well, that cartridge, that dummy bullet, the tip that was still in there, it got dislodged at the speed of a bullet and killed him. So that's a horrible tragedy, but it's not new to Hollywood. As a matter of fact, the Associated Press did an investigation from 1990 to 2016, and they found over 43 people had died on movie set accidents and 150 had sustained life-threatening injuries. Now, in any other workplace, would that be acceptable?
No, I mean, just I mean, that's a shocking statistic you've just given us. And it also tells me that, you know, if you're on notice about the prospect of it, if you have the if there is a protocol in place about the handling of weapons, you know, what is the impact, Richard, of their of knowing the potential for danger? I mean, it's one thing to have a protocol in place for non-dangerous activities, but is there a separate or additional requirement under the law or a way to evaluate it if you're talking about inherently dangerous activities?
Excellent point. This is why I know we're speaking lawyer to lawyer here. Yes, of course, when it's inherently dangerous instrumentality like a gun, the standards are definitely different. It's not a pen. It's a gun. If not used properly, not secured properly, it can obviously maim or kill someone. So, yes, there are definitely different standards. And it just seems to me that now we're talking about a gun. But if we were on another workplace, let's say I do a lot of construction accident, some terrible accidents happen here in New York City, and there are so many protocols in the construction industry because it's so inherently dangerous. You're 20 stories up. There are big holes. There are, you know, craters there to fall. You could fall into the street. You have to be secured. Well, there's a lot of great protocols, but they're only as good as the people that are following them, meaning the foresters and the supervisors. Just like here on the set, it is absolutely analogous to a movie set because a movie set is a workplace with dangerous conditions.
That's important to remember. It's a workplace. So how does insurance come into play here? The idea of how much you insure a set, I mean, or the ideas that would introduce in the civil liability context.
Sure. So in the case that obviously will be brought here by the family for damages for both her pain and suffering because she did not die immediately based on the reports and her wrongful death, The damages here are just, they're horrible, obviously, because of the fact she left a child. She has a large earnings capacity, the grief of the family, the loss of guidance of the child. All of these will be considered in the case. And, you know, I think what people don't understand, I think the general public says, oh, there's insurance, they'll pay for it. Okay. I wrote a book called Why Insurance Companies Hate When You Hire a Lawyer, and I'll tell you why. They hate it because I know what the general public doesn't know, which is, number one, they often fight cases tooth and nail. That's why you need trial lawyers like me, because we have to take cases to trial more times than you would think. And number two, so what's going to happen here is there'll be lawsuits filed. They'll be filed against the production company. Maybe Alec Baldwin is producer, not as active, but if he had an active role in the production. Obviously, the armorer and the assistant director allegedly handed it over, and the film company, they'll likely all be part of a civil lawsuit. So insurance companies, there'll be liability insurance for everyone, and the insurance companies will hire lawyers to defend. And they just don't roll over and pay out a settlement. It will likely be litigated, depositions, investigation. And eventually they'll come to a point where they either want to offer settlement or their case will go to trial and a jury will decide it. So it will probably be a drawn-out process. And I don't know if you recall, there was a case in 2014. It was horrible. It was a movie called Midnight Rider, and it was being filmed in Georgia. And they decided that it was a good idea to have a scene on a railroad track where they were putting a metal bed over the railroad track. And you can't believe this, but they did not get permission from the railroad to do this, from the movie company. And a train came. They didn't expect the train to come. I don't know why. They didn't read the schedule, but it was horrible. A train came. Everybody ran. A train hit the bed. Shrapnel from the train hit this 27-year-old assistant camera person, hit her, and then threw her into the oncoming train, and she died. This was absolutely horrible. And that's a case where actually, besides obviously the civil case, that's a case where there were two guilty pleas on both involuntary manslaughter and trespass. And one person decided to try the case, the criminal case. And she was the first assistant director, and she actually got convicted at the trial. And then in the civil case, as I'm saying about insurance companies, well, everybody settled out except the company that that was the train operator, very big corporation. And they decided that the train operator wasn't responsible, which obviously you have an obligation to see what's in front of you. And you see a metal bed at some distance, you have a certain braking distance that you
if you can stop
seeing
right?
this. Right. So the company, insurance company, obviously decided, no, we'll try the case. And the jury said, you know what? You are 35% liable. There may be other parties that already settled out liable. And the jury said that it's $11.2 million. And then when it was on appeal, it was settled. So when you hear insurance, it doesn't mean, oh, we're just handing over money. Not at all. And that's the case that certainly should have been settled by the train company. But they didn't until it was already on appeal.
And remind people how, how does the jury make the determination about the percentage of blame?
Yes, excellent. So a jury decides all the facts in the case. The judge talks about the law, the jury decides the facts, and they simply go into that room and they say, boy, what percentage do I think each of the parties were at fault? And it's totally within their province. They all sit there and discuss it. I have it in every one of my cases. And I have to say, almost all the time, they come out with something that's very reasonable. And how they get to it? It's a good question. I ask them these things all the time. It's usually some type of compromise they come up with among themselves. But the jurors that I've had in New York City over more than three decades, they really try hard and they really take it seriously and they do an excellent job.
Richard C. Bell, we have so much ahead of us still as they unpack this, the facts of this case, and we learn more and more about what's going on. But you and I both know the idea, if nothing's on the off the table, that's everything's on the table. So we'll
everything's on the table.
That's exactly right. You know, but it doesn't necessarily mean, again, criminal liability and prosecution. You know, you could very easily not have criminal prosecution, but it does not have the impact to foreclose civil remedies at all. That's an important point for people to realize. What the prosecutor might do in a criminal context or choose not to do in a criminal context, because there is just not the the evidence there to support the claim. And in New Mexico, there's also an excusable homicide statute that talks about the idea of, you know, if the person's engaged in otherwise lawful behavior and by accident or misfortune causes the death of the other person, they talk about the standard of care and the duty of care and acting reasonably. But if they don't have, if that's on the books for the criminal side, you can be sure that the civil liability is still on the table regardless.
Yes. In New Mexico, they have comparative negligence. It means, you know, different parties can be blamed differently. And I think what people need to remember is, because this always came up years ago, OJ, they charged, they acquitted, and then there was the wrongful death trial, the civil trial, where there was a judgment against him to pay money. So we got to remember, in the criminal sector, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And in the civil liability, it's you have to find a preponderance of the evidence, which is just a teensy weensy bit over 50% to find someone liable.
Wow. Good reminder and good context to give us all. Richard C. Bell, thank you for your time. As always, you can go learn more about him at his firm website, richardcbellesq.com. He's also the author of the book Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. You've seen him on CBS and CNBC and NBC, ABC and more. And he brings us the insight on civil liability as well. Richard C. Bell, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. Sorry it's such a tragic topic today, but I appreciate you inviting me.
I'm glad you were here. Thank you. We'll be right back after a quick break here on SiriusXM POTUS.